This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Eric Lomax was a POW during World War II, held in a slave labor camp run by the Japanese. He was brutally tortured, accused of being a spy, after guards found a radio that Lomax and other prisoners had secretly made. He went home to Britain after the war and tried to resume his life, but he was haunted by what he had endured and was suffering from what we would call PTSD. Years later, he met one of the men who had tortured him and began an unusual friendship, even though his first impulse was revenge. Lomax wrote about this in his 1995 memoir, The Railway Man, which is now a movie starring Colin Firth as Eric Lomax. Here's a scene from The Railway Man where Nicole Kidman, who plays Eric's wife Patty, confides in her husband's friend and war buddy, played by Stellan Skarsgård.
My husband isn't coping.
War leaves a mark, Mrs. Lomax.
But I don't believe in this code of silence that you have. I really don't. And you may be determined to stay screwed up and suffer for the rest of your life, but I don't want that for Eric, and I can't live like that. He's a wonderful man. I've seen it. I love him, and I want him back.
Joining us on Radio Times are Patty Lomax, the widow of Eric Lomax. And it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Andy Patterson, the film's producer and co-screenwriter. And Andy Patterson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. Patty, I'm curious, how many times have you seen this film?
Only three right through. The first time Andy brought it to a Berwick-upon-Tweed in North Northumberland, where I live, so that I could see it and to have a reaction from me. And that was unusual because I was looking at the actors and seeing what they could do too much, really. The second time was when it really grabbed me. And the third time I went with a friend.
I mean, it grabbed you because, in part, this was your marriage, this was your husband, this was your life, other people playing the people that you knew and loved.
I think it was because I was amazed that although it's a drama based on Eric's book, so much of the truth was within that drama. And Colin Firth had really caught my husband, and every now and again I would get a jolt because I was so much into the story that he really made me think, wow, you know, Eric's here, but of course he wasn't.
Was your husband as handsome as Colin Firth?
He was in his early days before he became very ill, yes. He had that certain something that in the 30s the girls had it.
That it thing. Mm. Did you meet on a train?
We did indeed. It wasn't quite as portrayed in the film. Eric did all the talking. I've accused my friend, the producer here, of giving the impression that I'm a tart when he explained that it was really to introduce the audience to the fact that Eric was very much a buttoned-up type of person. I didn't mind that too much.
Well, Andy Patterson, I know that when you read this book, and I read it yesterday, it's an extraordinarily beautifully written book, I should say, and it came out in 1995, and it sounds like this was a movie you've been wanting to make for almost 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually 15 years since we optioned the rights and met Eric and Patty, and I think the first question you ask when you read that book, as you say, it's so beautifully written, you ask yourself what you can do that would be worth doing beyond that. So we spent quite a long time getting to know them. It would be fair to say that we thought we were adapting the book and realized that we'd actually walked into a story that was in many ways still evolving because the events were still very fresh. When we said to Eric, you wanted to kill this man, and it didn't work out that way, how did that happen? He couldn't really explain it, and certainly not in a way that we could write. And it took many years to really understand what those experiences do to somebody, and then to try and find a way of dramatizing is a word that one has to be careful with, because it suggests that you're doing it differently. What we were actually trying to do was to capture the truth that he couldn't explain, and that actors could help you understand in a different way, but in some ways to try and get closer to the truth.
Well, and there are scenes in this film where he is really having flashbacks of what had happened to him in this brutal prison camp. And there must be certain kind of challenges as producer, filmmaker, to try to capture the kind of terror that someone must be experiencing inside. The rest of the world doesn't see it, but they see it.
We asked ourselves all the time how much of the brutality needed to be actually on screen and how much of it could be implicit. And, you know, I hope we've got the balance right. There's very little in screen time of those scenes, but you had to have some of that to honour the man and to honour what these people had gone through. So, yeah, very fine balance. They're very, you know, there are some very tough scenes, but only a few minutes of it.
Yeah, but I wonder to you, Patty, because you lived this, and in many ways this was a man who had endured unspeakable suffering during World War II. This was something that's hard to talk about even now, and I'm assuming even harder to talk about a couple of decades ago.
It took about, pardon me, 6 years to find out what really was hurting Eric, which was very frightening, very confusing to live with. But once he agreed that he would accept help from the Medical Foundation of the Care of Victims of Torture in London, they liked to have the families involved because their belief, which is true, the families are as affected by this condition as anybody else. So over a period of 2 years of very careful and counselling, expert counselling, the story was drawn from Eric, and I heard this, and of course it helped enormously to know what was behind his problems.
Do you think he was trying to protect you from his memories, his experiences?
From what I can gather, from what I've heard him say and other veterans say, initially perhaps that was the case, and also they came from a defeated army to, in our case, back to Britain. The war in Europe had been won and was over several months before. Nobody was particularly interested, so there was the protection. They didn't want to talk about it within their homes because it also, in their minds, dirtied their homes, bringing these evil things within it. But perhaps, you know, people had moved on, so what if somebody's got far-fetched stories about what happened to them?
And in that scene, we hear Nicole Kidman is talking about this code of silence. Mm. Andy?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this was a colossal story, but just bring this down to the obviously much more important problem of trying to, you know, be a screenwriter and deal with,
sure,
with writing. You know, if you want to have a character who can't speak, who doesn't know what's wrong with him, and, you know, he's your lead. Colin Firth is playing somebody who really can't tell you anything at the beginning of this film, which is a fascinating challenge from a writing point of view, but allowed us to go and see how much Eric could try and explain to us, see how we could bring things to him, and it became, I think, a very fascinating process of gradually evolving an understanding of what he'd been through, which is partly an excuse for why it took so long to get it right. But it was really important to me that we brought Patty's story to the fore. You've read the book.
I did.
Patty's barely mentioned.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's completely protection. I think that you are in some ways emotionally incapable of dealing with feelings about somebody that, as Stellan says in the film, who would like to love you, who wants to love you, but you somehow can't let them, because the memories you have of what you became back in the war, of the things you went through, means that if she knew what you'd become on that torture table, she could never love you. And so part of the journey that we try to tell in the film is to bring him back to a point where he becomes a man again.
Well, and just looking at what he wrote in the book, he says, and this is about you, Patty, my hurt response was never deliberate. It was a way of disappearing into myself, of adopting the impassive hurt features of the victim. I shut down as a way of protecting myself. Patty was bewildered by it. And I think a lot of people would connect with that particular passage.
Yes, I think so.
And how difficult it must have been, I mean, for you to sort of keep pushing him to...
Well, the problem was you couldn't push. You had to... It was like walking on eggshells because, as you saw in this beautiful scene of the two of them dancing together, right, you could be having such happy moments and then something could trigger this awful memory. And so you'd never knew what you were going to say that would trigger something bad for him. And it's very, very difficult.
Mm. Well, I'm sure. Mm. Did Nicole Kidman have specific questions for you about you at this time?
Nicole had done a lot of research before she met me. And I think we have a common... although our lives are totally different, we have a common link in that we have both had to protect our husbands at some point from the world. And so we didn't need to have a lot of talking. She instinctively knew what it was like, in a different context, obviously, but she was very, very clever with that, I think. But we did meet, and I like to think that perhaps as far as it's possible with two such different lives that we became friends.
What do you think, Andy?
She was... I'd actually done a very long interview on camera with Patty about a year, I don't know, 6 months before we started filming. And Nicole used that a lot. I think she didn't want to meet Patty until she felt she understood the role. But she was thrilled that she had such a direct but, you know... slightly objective way to research that. So she would ask very, very smart questions about the script in the run-up. Right. And then on a day when we were shooting in Berwick-upon-Tweed, up on the Scottish border, where Eric and Patty lived, I sort of kidnapped her really at lunchtime and said, you know, you've got to meet her now.
Ah.
And so we took Nicole and Colin to Eric and Patty's house, and they sat and had tea and told stories, and I was watching in through the sort of the glass doors, thinking partly, goodness me, this was an extraordinary end to a journey. but there were, you know, there were tears. And then they walked in the garden, and Patty and Nicole talked about roses, and it was just gorgeous.
Sounds very British.
We found we had a common interest in gardening, and we were both suffering from the lack of bees.
Aren't we all? Yes. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Patty Lomax. She's the widow of Eric Lomax, who wrote a memoir almost 20 years ago. It was published in 1995 called The Railway Man. It's now a movie starring Colin Firth, and I should also add Nicole Kidman playing Patty Lomax. Also with us is Andy Patterson. He's the film's producer and co-screenwriter. Any questions or comments, give us a call. That phone number 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hinnish Nua Theatre Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Hinnish Nua is currently presenting Midsummer, a play with songs by David Grieg and Gordon McIntyre, directed by Kate Galvin. On stage now through April 27th at the Off Broad Street Theatre, 1636 Sampson Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us.
It's been a while since Rushmore, but the movie star Jason Schwartzman will always remember the advice that Bill Murray gave him on set.
I remember at one point I said to Bill, "Why do you think my character likes your character?" And he said, "Oh, now you're acting. Just say your lines and be funny."
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Jason Schwartzman on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Stephen Colbert has been named as the successor to David Letterman on The Late Show. How will he handle the transition? Maybe like the time he came on The Late Show dressed like a Dickens character.
Dave, It's actually me.
Oh, I had no idea.
Stephen Colbert.
We'll check in on the shakeup in late night TV with NPR's Eric Deggans next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about a new movie called The Railway Man, based on a 1995 memoir written by Eric Lomax about his years as a British POW in a brutal Japanese labor camp. This was during World War II. He was beaten. He was tortured. He came home a broken man. And through a series of circumstances, he later met his torturer and eventually forgave him for what he did. And we're talking about this story, Eric Lomax's life with his widow Patty Lomax and with Andy Patterson. He's the producer of the film, also the co-screenwriter. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Was it hard for you? I have to say it was hard for me, but was it hard for you, Patty, to see some of these scenes where Eric, your husband, played by Colin Firth, but as a young man, to see him being so brutally tortured?
Oh, desperately hard, because it's a very different thing in knowing something or reading about it, but to actually see what went on. It was dreadful.
Yes.
But fortunately, that only lasts for a very short time, and I did look away.
I did as well, and I also flinched. But I also felt, Andy, that it was important for people to understand what Eric had been through, and he was part of this group of POWs. They made a radio, accused of being a spy, thinking that they could, you know, get the outside world, talk to the outside world. And he's saying, no, it's just a radio, so we can hear the outside world.
Well, it was, if any of us can try and imagine, back in 1942, they were so young, and, you know, they'd have come from towns and villages. There was no travel, there was no internet, there was really very little knowledge of that outside world. And to find yourself in a strangely beautiful part of the world, 5,000 miles from home, being subjected to inhuman treatments. And what Eric tried to do in building those radios, and many other people too, right, was to try and quite literally bring hope by bringing news from the outside world that the Americans were fighting their way through the Pacific, that Hitler had been turned around at Stalingrad, that there was a chance that the war was going to turn. And Eric said to me once, you would whisper a little fragment of news and see 1,000 backs straighten as people decided to get through that day. And for his troubles, he was suspected of being a spy. This railway was a 215-mile stretch which would complete a railway line that would go from China all the way through to India, which meant that the Japanese could supply their ambitions without resorting to the seas. But it was being built through a section of mountain and jungle that the Victorian British, who were not known for their concern for the workers, one might say, even they'd abandoned the idea of doing this many years ago because of the loss of life.
Through jungle, through mountains.
Yeah, and as I said, beautiful, rock. Actually. Eric talks about how you would stand there looking at this extraordinarily beautiful terrain, but with its disease, with the hunger, with the brutality. And of course, for Eric, the extraordinary irony of a man who his life had loved trains and found himself shipped to this place to build what became known as the Death Railway.
And I'm curious, even as the producer of the film, just sort of how much you wanted the audience to experience of what he went through. And, you know, sometimes you can do with sound design, you know, what you can hear, what maybe you can't see. But I'm wondering what the thinking was, or even the discussion about. So just how much should we show about what Eric Lomax went through?
Yeah, I mean, the discussion was from the first moment we read the book until the last piece of editing, because it was such a fine balance. You had to honour these men. You had to show what they went through, but it takes very little. And, you know, we're used to movies which are completely full of violence, but the violence is not real. And it's often quite tedious these days. But when you are portraying something in a very simple way that we do, and because you know it's a true story, mm-hmm. because the actors are so remarkable, you know, we measured it frame by frame as to what you needed to see to do justice to the story. If you read the book, it's obviously in some ways if I can say it that way, easier to read it than it is to see it. We showed a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what these men went through, but we felt that if we didn't, then it would make it impossible for you to understand what they were trying to recover from.
Again, quoting from the book, Eric Lomax, your husband, writes that to have to witness the torture of others and to see the preparations for the attack on one's own body is a punishment in itself, especially when there is no escape. This experience is the beginning of a form of insanity. And I circled that just because I felt, goodness, great. You know, it's just, as I said to you before we went on the air, I don't know how someone survives what your husband survived.
No.
Mentally. Physically, but mentally.
Yes. If I may just jump forward a little bit, I do not like the modern day expression that these men have mental problems, as though they have schizophrenia or something like that. These are war injuries that lead to these problems, and I think it's very important that we even let modern day veterans of the Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever, feel that they're not being classed as underdogs. They have been damaged just as well as the man next to them who's lost a leg. I think that's very important. But on the other hand, I don't know, and I cannot say exactly why so many of the Far Eastern prisoners of war, there were some Americans there, not too many, there are a few Canadians also, mainly Australians and the British, and a great number of civilian Chinese who, that's another story, but they lost enormous number of lives. How so many recovered enough to come home? Yeah. It must have taken a great strength of spirit
to be able to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. You do, Andy Patterson, in this film, we show Eric Lomax being tortured. We see him being waterboarded, which in this country is an issue that people have still debated about. Is this torture? Is it not torture? What we see is him being half drowned, and then, in a sense, sort of brought back to life, and then half drowned again. Is it torture from your perspective?
Well, Eric spoke to us a lot about it. He wrote a piece for the Times in London when waterboarding became something that everybody was talking about many years ago. Whatever you want to say about the right to use it, you have to call it torture. I mean, it is, without any question, the most terrifying thing that you can possibly do to somebody. And it's, if you look back over history, you know, the Spanish Inquisition used water torture and called it water torture. The Gestapo used it and called it enhanced interrogation. And, you know, it's sort of sad to see the American and the British referring it to it in those terms. There's no question that it's torture. And that, like all forms of torture, you have to be so careful to believe that any information that is gathered that way is going to be worth it. People will do anything to stop it.
And that's Andy Patterson. He's the producer, also a co-screenwriter of a new film. It's called The Railway Man, and it's based on a memoir that Eric Lomax wrote back in the 1990s. He died a couple of years ago before the film was completed. His widow, Patty Lomax, is with us, and we're talking about this very important story. It's about a man surviving a Japanese labor camp during World War II, and his eventual ability to be able to forgive the torturer, the man who tortured him. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Have you been, Patty, or I know you have been to this part of the world that we're talking about, been with your husband?
Oh, yes, I was with him when he actually met Mr. Nagase, the cause of some of his problems. We went again to meet Mr. Nagase and his wife later. It's the most beautiful part of the world, but it's being rather turned into a tourist trap, I'm afraid. It's changed greatly, of course, since these young men first met there.
Is there any evidence of the camps or the people were being held there?
I don't think there are the camps, but there are museums and plaques. And now, because Mr. Nagase returned most of his post-war life so many times to Thailand and did many good works, particularly for the Thai children, they have erected a statue, full-size statue, at the end of the River Kwai Bridge in his honour, which is lovely. I'd love to go and see that. I haven't done yet.
And she mentioned River Kwai. I mean, there's a sort of, I guess, a fictional, semi-fictional account, not exactly of what we're talking about, but it's sort of a parallel story.
Well,
Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Yeah, Bridge Over the River Kwai is a wonderful film. It has absolutely nothing to do with the true story. The veterans, if they'll forgive me speaking for them, despise the film because it shows a lot of well-fed extras showing the Japanese how to build a railway. And it is a novel. It says on the front of the film that it's a work of fiction. But as it has been really the most visible way of people understanding anything about this story, I think the veterans felt really, really let down by it. And it was one of the real joys. We, at the London premiere of the film a little while ago, we were able to bring a dozen veterans of the railway, and they spoke about feeling that their story had been told, that this film actually, because we were able to shoot on the real locations, we were able to do it the way that it actually was.
Go ahead, Patty.
One of those veterans had actually witnessed Eric's torture.
Oh, really?
And it was amazing because he hadn't thought that Eric would live. And so he was so pleased to hear from me that he had.
I do want to read something else from his book, and this is where he's been sentenced to death, and he writes, "It's a strange feeling being sentenced to death in your early 20s. It made me feel relaxed in a strange way to know that I was living on borrowed time." Then he goes on to say, "They left me my imagination, and it was a worse tormentor than they could ever be. I expected death, but had no clear image of an ending that would make sense to me. I was now living in a world without rules. They could make up their own, and there were no grids or points of reference at all." I mean, just to be so completely and utterly alone and helpless and at the mercy of your tormentors.
Yes, and it was during that time that Eric wrote the poem, which is spoken in the film about the clock.
Ah,
the clock struck one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Part of this story, and Patty referenced it, was that Eric does meet up with one of his torturers through a number of unusual circumstances. Can you tell that part of the story, Annie?
Yes. I mean, as we tell it in the film, it's obviously a slightly truncated version of events, but Nagase was the interpreter, and Eric often said that one of the reasons that he was the focus of Eric's hatred was because, unlike some of the thugs who were doing the beatings, it was very clear that this was an intelligent, educated man, similar to Eric's age, you know, again, very, very young. And he could never forgive him for not knowing better than to be part of this. After the war, Nagase wrote a short book called Crosses and Tigers. And I think Patty should tell this part of the story because, you know, she was there.
Yes, she was. Go ahead, Patty.
Well, again, we were on a train travelling from A to B, and Eric opened the morning's post to find within one of the envelopes a cutting from the Japanese English language newspaper, the main one, describing this book and showing a photograph of Mr. Nagase as he was during the war. And Eric instantly recognised him. Shortly after that, Eric was given a copy of the book Crosses and Tigers in English. Eric read it, made no comment at all. The shutters came down. Mm. A few days later, I read it. And on page 17 onwards, there is a full description of Eric and Eric's torture and how it had bothered this young man at the time. Further on, it describes how the writer had had a supernatural, I could describe it, event, one of the war memorials in an Allied cemetery in Kanchanaburi, and had felt forgiven. And I felt so angry that this awful man could feel that way when my poor husband was still suffering as he was, that I asked Eric if I might write to him. I never did anything without asking him and showing what I wrote, and he approved the second draft of my letter, and off it went. And that was the beginning of a series of letters between Mr. Nagase and myself until Eric felt that he could take over the writing.
In fact, you said to him, "How can you feel forgiven, Mr. Nagase, if this particular prisoner of war has not yet forgiven you?" This particular prisoner of war was your husband.
Absolutely.
And he wrote back, "Your letter has beaten me down, reminding me of my dirty old days."
Yes.
But that was the beginning.
Yes. Of a series of letters which Eric approved, and obviously he read the replies. And then eventually, after five or six, he was able to take up the writing himself.
Did Eric want revenge on Mr. Nagase?
He did indeed. Right up to the moment of meeting, he was a very good actor, my husband, as he'd learnt to be in prison camp.
And he's nodding his head, yes.
Yes, and the impression to everybody was that he was going to meet Mr. Nagase. It took about 2 years for him to agree to go. To meet him in friendship, and not a bit of it. It was as shown on the film. And or can I just say, yes. Towards the end of the film, there's the very dramatic part where Colin is going through some this revenge feeling. It is literally showing the audience what Eric was thinking. So it is correct. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what he was thinking was he would do to Mr. Nagase what had been done to him, Andy.
There's a little phrase in the book which actually defines the entire third act of the film from my point of view. He says, "I looked at the picture of him, I wanted to drown him, to cage him, to beat him, to see how he liked it." And that gave us the way into talking to Eric about this. It's the first time Paddy's said he's a good actor, but it's if you imagine that over the time that it took for people to talk about counselling, the idea that he might go and meet this man, and all that time he was thinking, "I will go through this, but then I will have my chance for revenge." And how that process unravelled from feeling that killing him was the only way to bring peace to what actually happened was about as fascinating a story as I'm ever going to come across.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Andy Patterson, and he's the producer, co-screenwriter of a new film called The Railway Man, again, based on this 1995 memoir we've been talking about, Eric Lomax writing that memoir about being a British POW in a brutal Japanese labor camp during World War II. And we are joined by his widow, Patty Lomax, and again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove supports WHYY. From April 12th through the 27th, the museum and the center's annual juried art show will be open to the public. In addition to original works inspired by nature, this year's show features a flock of hundreds of origami passenger pigeons commemorating the centennial of the species extinction. Visitors can hike more than 5 miles of historic trails in the footsteps of America's best-known bird artist. For more information, online, johnjames.audubon.org.
Did you ever have to find a way to survive? And you knew your choices were bad, but you had to survive.
American Hustle is out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from David O. Russell, who directed and co-wrote the film. He's described American Hustle and his films The Fighter and Silver Linings Playbook as a trilogy with a common theme of reinvention. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
When the inmates run the jail and get the guards to do their bidding.
The Black Gorilla family corrupts these female guards And then they bring in the drugs that meet the demand of the addicted inmates.
Jeffrey Toobin on the black guerrilla family gang dominance of a Baltimore jail and what that says about the criminal justice system right now. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Patty Lomax and Andy Patterson about what became an unusual relationship or friendship, the friendship between Eric Lomax, a POW during World War II, and a man who was one of his interrogators, one of his torturers, and it's the subject of a memoir which came out in the 90s called The Railway Man, and now featured in this new film called also The Railway Man, and it stars Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman. I'm thinking about forgiveness, and I know it took a while, I guess, for your husband to forgive this man, Mr. Nagase, but I sometimes think it's harder for the person who loves the person who's been hurt to forgive than the person who's been hurt to forgive, and I wonder if that was true for you, Pat.
It was. It took Eric several weeks to really, on the one hand, make sure that Mr. Nagase was genuine, and on the other hand, for him to work out how he himself felt. And that, as we know, he took his decision to forgive this man. It took me a lot longer. Excuse me. And I had to give myself a good talking to and to think to myself, if Eric were to forgive him, who was I not to also?
But it was maybe harder for you? I don't mean harder, but just you had to go through a different process in order for you to forgive this man?
Yes, I did, because I suppose the nearest thing I can liken it to is a mother hen and having had her chick misused. An element of that.
Yeah.
His life had been ruined by that time. And even at the end, he only partially recovered. It was almost like a convalescence.
Mm.
And I do think that my husband was a very clever, astute man who could have gone far if he had wanted to without all this baggage that he was carrying. It blighted his life. It blighted his first marriage, his children too. Two of them died. He had three. The one who is left, Charmaine, is a lovely lady, but she is aware that, you know, life has been affected by her father's trauma. It was very hard for everybody, apart from myself.
Sure, sure. Do you see this as a war story, a love story? I mean, how do you see the film that you have produced?
Well, it's a unique story. We worked with a lady called Helen Bamber, who runs the Medical Foundation, who is really the first person that allowed Eric to believe that maybe there might be a way out of this. She was a remarkable woman. At 19, she went into Belsen. She spent her life dealing with the victims of appalling circumstances. But there would have been no way forward for Eric without Patty, because if you can find yourself with somebody who wants to love you and who you're trying to push away for reasons that we've discussed, that you feel that you could never be loved if she knew what you had become. But who, as you say in the film, you know, she saw him, she wanted him back, and she had the strength to find out what was wrong and to push him to get help, and in the end to have the courage to let him go and meet this man.
Yeah.
So that love story is absolutely crucial to Eric's experience. It's crucial to the film. It makes the film, you know, incredibly charming and romantic. And Colin was very, very keen that from his point of view in how to play this role, he knew this was a man who could not have the woman that he wanted unless he could dispose of the past. And so when the Stellan Skarsgård character comes to him in the most brutal way to say, you're the only one, effectively, who has a chance of happiness. It's too late for the rest of us.
Yeah.
But all those men wanted one of them to be happy. And so pushes him to go and do it, to go and meet this man and get this out of the way. And that opens the door to the happiness he didn't believe. He said to me once, this wasn't acting, but it was one hell of a performance, when he said to me, you know, Andy, I never expected to be happy ever again.
Really? It's a powerful thing to say.
Yeah.
But I guess he got some happiness towards the end of his life, Patty. Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of his life, he could openly say that he loved me.
Ah.
Which was something that he had found very difficult to do, even in the beginning.
Because he somehow felt unlovable, or he was incapable of love.
As Andy has explained, yes.
Do you know why he forgave Mr. Nagase, Andy? It's an extraordinary thing to do. And
yes,
not only that, but it sounds like to even become a kind of a... They were good friends.
When Mr. Nagase died, Eric wrote a eulogy which was read out at Mr. Nagase's funeral. Mr. Nagase, I'm sorry, I'm coming. Mr. Nagase called them blood brothers.
Ah, because they had... What they had been through so much.
Yeah.
We had to try to understand, otherwise we wouldn't have made the film. And so Helen Bamber told us a lot of things about what torture does to a man.
Yeah.
And she explained it in pretty tough terms. But obviously there is the pain. And as every woman knows, pain is something you can forget about with time. But the real legacy of that torture is to find yourself with everything that makes you a human being stripped from you. You know, as Helen put it, your body lets you down, and you find that you are at the mercy of these people who are trying to do everything they possibly can. They take your humanity. And through having the opportunity to meet this man and to have the power of life and death over this man, he was able to restore some of that balance. He went into that situation fully intending to kill him and feeling that killing him would take away the pain. And then he met him. He found that he was an ordinary human being like him, but he could still kill him. And he, I think, wanted to do that for quite a long time, but found that in having that power and being able to throw some things back at this man, we refuse to accept that an ordinary Japanese person is any different from an ordinary British or American person. We're all driven to survive. People survive, human beings survive the most extraordinary troubles. And yet, the Japanese were forced to believe that surrender was the greatest humiliation, that death was better than surrender. And yet, at the end of the war, they didn't die.
No.
They surrendered. And allowing Eric to throw these things back, to regain that sense of injustice, really, because what human beings are really not very good at is dealing with injustice, and this is injustice on an unimaginable scale. And so we tried to demonstrate that through this extraordinary encounter, which is the third act of the film, to a point where it made sense for him to say that the pain went away, because things had actually happened. Scores had been settled, but actually dignity and humanity had been restored to him. So it's a fascinating process, possibly unique, but at least gives you an insight into it being more.
But I think from reading the book and even looking at the film, Patty, it seems as if your husband recognized that Mr. Nagase had also suffered.
Yes, he did. But also, Eric came to the conclusion, as the last line of the book and the last line of the film and the line which is on his gravestone, sometime the hating has to stop.
Right.
And he truly believed that.
That it just had to stop for him so that he could live his
forward.
Life.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. This film is premiered in Toronto, the Toronto Film Festival. And actually, Andy, you were telling me kind of a funny story about Patty and the she's looking at you now, glaring at you. But I think you gave us permission to do this.
Well, I've never told this story.
So go ahead.
There we are, 14 years from the first time that we met, the Toronto Film Festival, the opening Friday night gala. Patty there on the red carpet being interviewed, and I had decided, in all sort of theatrical ways, that there was no point bringing Patty on at the beginning of the screening because this was the first time the film had ever been seen, but I wanted to bring her on at the end.
Right.
But that amazing Roy Thomson Hall in Toronto, it's a very long way from these pods that you sit in to the stage, and this film of all films is not a film you can leave early. So we decided that we would just put her in the front row, and at the end of the film we could bring the spotlights on and tell the audience. And she'd be sitting between Colin and Nicole, which wouldn't be too bad.
Too bad at all.
So I went down and we did the introductions on stage at the beginning of the screening. And as I snuck into my seat, somebody came to me and said, there's a tiny problem. And so I went out and they said, Patty, who is one of the most courageous women I've ever met, nonetheless suffers from vertigo. And there's a huge drop from the front row of those pods. And so she couldn't sit there. So she was in the back row. I said, that's okay, we'll just put the spotlights on the back row. But, to our delight but surprise, at the end of the film, there was a huge standing ovation. And so the spotlights wouldn't be able to find her. So I had to go up to the back of this area and say to Patty, I'm very sorry, but the next couple of minutes are going to be a little bit bumpy. And had to literally carry her down these steps. And I ended this 14-year journey on my knees behind her, holding her by the waist so that she could see the spotlights and wave to an audience that was so astonished when the director said the real Patty Lomax is in the audience. There was a gasp like I've never heard before.
Wow.
And
so I guess you're really good friends now. Patty, I'm looking at you.
Almost. It felt like
I'm not sure
you have
quite
direction.
Forgiven him for pushing you into the spotlight like that. But what has the spotlight been like for you? This must be a very new experience.
It's been surreal. I'm just a housewife who happened to marry a man who was wonderful. And because he's not here, I'm Plan B.
You're Plan B.
And I'm happy to be Plan B.
Do you think of her as Plan B?
No, no, it goes right the way back. You know, I was absolutely determined that her story, representing the millions of families who dealt with the real wreckage of war, should be central to the film. Mm-hmm. She's described her husband as stubborn. She can be quite hard to convince too. But if I may, that there was a moment on Eric's 90th birthday when Patty had thrown a lunch and there were a number of guests there. And as they were leaving, I was sitting with Patty in the lobby, and I'd been trying to get her to open up and to accept that her story was as important as everybody else's. And as we sat there, people were drifting away, and they all came by and in one way or another said, you know, Patty, without you, he would have died in misery like the rest of them.
Oh, wow.
And that was the point at which I think I finally made her accept that she represented something much more than just herself. And when we send men and women to war, we should look at the full balance sheet of the consequences, because
the families,
the wreckage that you leave, is much, much bigger than just the direct cost of the war.
How much of how much of this film did Eric see? I mean, I know he died before it was completed, but was he able to see scenes or look at scripts? Or
he was very much kept with the film team, informed by the film team. By that time, when the filming started, Eric was very frail. Not in mind, but his body was letting him down. So he couldn't go to most of the shoots, but they did get him to one of them. And that's the one, I don't know whether you remember, with the scene of Colin standing overlooking the Berwick-on-Tweed viaduct and the view around there. And Eric thought that it was one of the best days of his life. He died when the film was in the final edit, and perhaps it was as well, because he didn't want to see the film, and he didn't want to be misunderstood by people. He just felt it would be so well done, which it is. It would remind him of bad times, which he did not want to revisit.
Is it hard to raise money for a film like this?
Well, it took me 14 years to get it done, but It's difficult, particularly with this film, because there was no point doing it unless we could do it on the scale that it needed to be done, which meant shooting in Scotland, shooting in Thailand, the building of the Death Railway, two time periods. And so it costs a lot of money. And people are very nervous of dramas. One of the wonderful things about the fact that it's done such great business in the UK and Australia, where it's already opened, is that I think we've shown that audiences are hungry for proper stories. And it's been a real word-of-mouth success. And hopefully it might make it a little bit easier to convince financiers that audiences really do want something beyond the normal fare that they're offered. It was made considerably easier by reaching the point where I felt that I could send it to Colin Firth. And Colin had had the remarkable timing of being just about to win an Oscar when I sent it to him.
Oh, for The King's Speech?
Yeah, yeah. So that made a difference. And then he called on a couple of his friends like Nicole. And,
finally, not too shabby.
Not too shabby.
And we should add, we're almost out of time here, but your husband's memoir, The Railway Man, is now on the bestseller list in England, yes.
Well, it has been.
It has been.
Of course, over the early months of the year. I don't quite know where it is at the moment, but certainly for 8 weeks it was.
Yeah. And it's never been out of print in all the years it has been published.
No, it's become a classic.
Well, on that note, it's been such a pleasure to meet you and to talk to you, Patty Lomax. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And Andy Patterson, thank you very much for joining us as well.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking with Patty Lomax, the widow of Eric Lomax. She's portrayed by Nicole Kidman in the new film, The Railway Man. Andy Patterson, a producer, co-screenwriter of The Railway Man. He's also produced several other films, including The Girl with the Pearl Earring and Hillary and Jackie. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.